Thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's a particular delight to be at Maynooth University, since it was very nearly my alma mater. How did that happen? Well, in 1969, I was of an age, I suppose, to go to university, and it seemed I didn't quite have the appropriate number of, or combination of A's and B's to get into Queen's University, Belfast. I mean, that was the era in which, if one was from the north, one either went to Queen's or didn't. But it was more like, that was it. That was a simpler era. And so it looked kind of dicey for a moment, because I was kind of literal-minded and I didn't have quite the right combination of A's and B's or C's or whatever. So I began to make other plans, and my plan involved being in touch with the very Reverend Tomás O'Fee, who was the president of Maynooth, and who had been, he was an Armagh man, of course, and he had played a very important role in giving us, in a sense, of the tradition, in particular of the poems of South Armagh, the poems by Seamus Donald MacCurta and Pádraig O'Durnín, fabulous Art McCooey, the fabulous poets of South Armagh who were writing in Irish, of course. And I mention him today because, to some extent, his support, and in fact his support to the extent that he was willing to take me into Maynooth as a student on the strength of the translations from Irish I had already made, which was saying a lot. I mean, the man was very generous to an 18-year-old. And I thought on this occasion I would, in his memory and in his honour, and also partly in honour and in the memory of Muireann Ní Bhrolchain, who was mentioned earlier on, I thought I'd read a few of these Ón Rua variations that Peter Denman mentioned. They were published in last week's Irish Times. I had a wonderful letter, an email, from someone the following day saying, you know, I hate to break this to you, but we don't really think Ón Rua O'Sullivan wrote that text at all. It was almost certainly written by someone else, and I'm sure you're operating on a piece of false information that comes from Kinsella's and Dúnara from so many years ago. So I wrote back to her and I said, thank you so much. I was aware there was some question of this, but I know would it be okay to say that it's generally ascribed to Ón Rua O'Sullivan? And I'm not sure if she's quite let me off the hook. I don't know. And Ón Rua O'Sullivan, if you remember, flourished is the word. I think it is the word, actually. Well, he lived between 1748 and 1782. And what I'm going to do is to read two or three of these, and then I'll read a couple of other poems, and then I'll read another two or three of these, right? And then I'll read a couple of other poems, and then I'll read the final three of these. And by that stage, we'll be done. Because I'm sure you've many other things to be doing what day of the week is this? Tuesday afternoon. So the text of which these are the variations is this. The Hrascar and Seal is Hage and Rich Mar Small. Alistran, Kaiser, is in Maid Shin a V in a Barch. Tawan Chower, na Fair. Is Fech and Three, Murnata. Is na sasani fein the vejer gwaidish bas. On Easter Monday, I was still en route from Drumcondra to the GPO when I overheard a dispute between a starch shirt cuckoo and a meadow pipit. The pipit singing even as it flew between its perch on a wicker-covered carboy and the nest it had improvised near a clump of gorse from strands of linen spun by Henry Joy and the mane of a stalking horse. The cuckoo that had shouldered out the hoi polloi, showing not a hint of remorse. Now the world's been brought low, the winds heavy with soot. Alexander and Caesar, all their retinue. We've seen Tara buried in grass, Troy trampled underfoot. The English, their days are numbered too. Of the 900 Mauser rifles, Erskine Childers and the boys unloaded from the Asgard in Hoth, most were deployed to the volunteers. Childers traced Hoth to its source in the Old Norse, the Vikings being among the first to beat their ploughshares into swords. On account of his opposition to it, the headstrong O'Rahilly was simply not made aware of the impending ding-dong, even though the blacksmiths on Mountjoy Square had been going at it hammer and tongs. The wind blows ash, now the world's completely destroyed. Alexander, Caesar, each leading a mighty force. Tara's overgrown. Look at the cut of Troy. With the English, things may eventually take their course. At Jacob's Biscuit Factory, Thomas McDonough sends up a flare through the arrowroot-scented air. On Stephen's Green, meanwhile, the English try to wrong-foot us by launching a two-pronged attack on our trenches. The more we're spurned, Roger Casement once opined, the more we're engrossed. His submarine shaking from stem to stern as it hugged the Kerry coast. The least stone, he went on, the least stone in a cairn is entitled to make one boast. The whole world is laid waste. Cinders flying through the air. Caesar and Alexander and their battle throngs. There's hardly a trace of Tara. Troy's barely there. The English themselves will shortly be moving along. So I'll just break away from that, if I may, read a couple of poems set up in the part of Armagh where I was brought up, the parish of Loch Gall. This first one has to do with the impact of the Cuban Missile Crisis on the parish of College Lands, Cuba. My eldest sister arrived home that morning in her white muslin evening dress. Who the hell do you think you are, running out to dances and next to nothing, as though we hadn't enough bother with the world at war, if not at an end? My father was pounding the breakfast table. Those Yankees were touch and go as it was. If you'd heard Patton in Armagh, but this Kennedy's nearly an Irishman. So he's not much better than ourselves. And him with only to say the word. If you've got anything on your mind, maybe you should make your peace with God. I could hear May from beyond the curtain. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I told a lie once. I was disobedient once. And Father, a boy touched me once. Tell me, child, was this touch immodest? Did he touch your breast, for example? He brushed against me, Father, very gently. Anshaw. When the master was calling the roll at the primary school in College Lands, you were meant to call back Anshaw and raise your hand as your name occurred. Anshaw meaning here, here and now, all present and correct, was the first word of Irish I spoke. The last name on the ledger belonged to Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward and was followed, as often as not, by silence, knowing looks, a nod and a wink, the master's droll, and where's our little ward of court? I remember the first time he came back. The master had sent him out along the hedges to weigh up for himself and cut a stick with which he would be beaten. After a while, nothing was spoken. He would arrive, as a matter of course, with an ash plant, a sally rod, or finally, the hazel wand he had whittled down to a whiplash. Its twist of red and yellow lacquers, sanded and polished, and altogether so delicately wrought that he had engraved his initials on it. I last met Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward in a pub just over the Irish border. He was living in the open, in a secret camp on the other side of the mountain. He was fighting for Ireland, making things happen. And he told me, Joe Ward, of how he had risen through the ranks to quartermaster, commandant. How every morning at parade, his volunteers would call back Anshaw and raise their hands as their names occurred. So, this next one, it's such a treat, I suppose it's a treat, to come here. Anyone, would you, I know you're a few coughs there, would you like, anyone need a drop of water? I don't know, if you have a cup, I'll give you some water. What do we say? Can you remember the olden days? We just needed a gree, actually, to open a bottle nowadays. Oh, there it is. Okay. So nice to come here along the M50, I guess. And, you know, in the olden days, 50 years ago, living in the north, people would say, you know, we have our problems, but the roads are great. And they don't say that anymore. They say, well, our problems may have diminished ever so slightly. And the roads are very good down there. But So this is a poem about how good the roads used to be in up in the north. It's a poem about the first, you know, you can see that, you know, if I'm writing a poem about how good the roads used to be, you can see that a poem may be about almost anything at all. It's a poem having to do with the first roundabout in Ireland, north or south. And it was at Ballygolly. Some of you may be familiar with it, right? And that, for a while, was just, it was like, it was a feat of engineering on a par with Tara, or maybe the pyramids. And it was very, very exciting to think that this new phenomenon would make our lives so much more streamlined. You know, and we could, well, of course, we had to come to that thing and go round it, and then you could decide which way you were going. But in any case, it was a very, very interesting time, at least for us, because we didn't have a lot to do up there. And I was saying to somebody the other day, such a different era. The first time I came to Dublin Airport was to see a plane take off and perhaps land. I wasn't actually getting onto a plane, just coming to see it take off or land. So that gives you a sense of where we were on the social front. And so one of the things we did was to visit graveyards, which is perhaps still a... Is that something people still do? Yeah, graveyard visitation, very, very big. And we would go there, we would visit the graveyard, we'd talk about the people who were... Well, my parents talked about the people who were buried there and what they were like and, you know, various stories about them. It was a great afternoon out. And then, so I mentioned that the B Specials, some of you may recall, were the second division of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, and they were disbanded in the early 1970s because of their poor behaviour, the Sightseers. My father and mother, my brother and sister, and I, with Uncle Pat, our dour, best-loved uncle, had set out that Sunday afternoon in July in his broken-down Ford, not to visit some graveyard. One died of shingles, one of fever, another's knees turned to jelly. But the brand-new roundabout at Ballygolly, the first in Mid-Ulster. Uncle Pat was telling us how the B Specials had stopped him one night somewhere near Ballygolly and smashed his bicycle and made him sing the sash and curse the Pope of Rome. They held a pistol so hard against his forehead, there was still the mark of an O when he got home. This next one, let me just move from... actually, I've written out a little bit of the old Owen Ruhr, supposed Owen Ruhr, ascribed. Doesn't really matter who wrote this. It's such a fabulous poem. Certainly it has a very particular point, and it certainly gets it across. And of course, what I'm trying to do here is to psych myself into the mind of someone who's taking part in the rising. Rather than adjourn to a gin palace for which so many yearned, Joseph Mary Plunkett has adjourned to the GPO, where the O'Rahilly's now doing his utmost to shove himself from pillar to post in his newfound zeal to throw off the English yoke and settle our old score. On Sackville Street, a girl who seemed to be about to choke has coughed up something from her very core. She wipes her mouth on her jute cloak and reloads her grandfather's four-bore. The sky is full of coal dust. The old order's overturned. Caesar and Alexander, their massed hosts. Tara was burned. Troy was burned. One of these days, the English will give up the ghost. I've watched Countess Markievicz striding through the oaks where our aspirations turn out to be pigs and pokes. This rifle was used against the Muslim sepoys in Cawnpore before being turned on the Boers. But that its firing pin is sticking is a sign of a more general morass in which we found her. The thin red line at Balaclava is testimony less to the officer class than the rank and file. The din of the sacking of Sackville Street. Looters, broken glass, the world laid waste, the wind heavy with smoke. Alexander the Great, Great Caesar, their assorted core. Tara is buried under grass. Even Troy's defences broke. In the case of the English, much the same lies in store. McDonough is tapping out some rhythmic verse on a biscuit tin. In Cawnpore, the sepoys were each sewn into a pigskin before being hanged en masse. On Stephen's Green, we got a whiff of that chlorine gas with its distinctive pepper pineapple smell. The meadow pipit was shaking from stern to stem as she pointed to the shell of the cuckoo's egg. She'd been condemned to billet. As a dead horse's belly swells, it pushes a sniper out of his nest into murder and mayhem. The wind all smut and smur. The world spins out of control. Alexander and Caesar, their gangs under grass, like Tara of the Kings. Have you seen the shape Troy's in? As for the English, that cup too will pass. So a little change of tone. We'll get over to the US of A. This poem set in a house I lived in for quite a long time, just outside Princeton, on a canal, the Delaware and Raritan Canal, which was built by Irish navvies, as of course was were so many of the canals in and indeed other feats of engineering. By Irish workers. So they show up in this poem. When I lived in this house, which was built in about 1750, I sometimes thought I could hear them. I don't quite believe in ghosts, but then I don't quite not believe in them, I suppose. But I could sort of hear them speaking in Irish, I suppose. The spirits of them, of so many of thousands of people who died, either from the sheer hard work or from cholera, which, of course, was cholera in the 1830s was when this work was being done. It was very pandemic. In any case, so there, somewhere in the back of this poem, and there's a reference to modern famine, contemporary famine in Africa. Anyway, it's a poem, like many poems, I suppose, and songs, of course, that has a little refrain. When I put my finger to the hole, it's called the loaf, the loaf. When I put my finger to the hole, they've cut for a dimmer switch in a wall of plaster stiffened with horsehair. It seems I've scratched a 200-year-old itch with a pink and a pink and a pinky pick. When I put my ear to the hole, I'm suddenly aware of spades and shovels turning up the gain all the way from Raritan to the Delaware with a clink and a clink and a clinky click. When I put my nose to the hole, I smell the floodplain off the canal after a hurricane and the spots of green grass where thousands of Irish have lain with a stink and a stink and a stinky stick. When I put my eye to the hole, I see one holding horse dung to the rain, in the hope, indeed, indeed, of washing out a few whole ears of grain. With a wink and a wink and a winky wick. And when I do at last succeed in putting my mouth to the horsehair-fringed niche, I can taste the small loaf of bread he baked from that whole seed with a link and a link and a linky lick. So, couple little family poems. We need to move along. So there's a poem called At Least They Weren't Speaking French. And it's about my son, I think he was about maybe, let's say, 10 at the time, and myself taking a drive through County Tyrone, Armagh, and thinking about times that were. Two of my father's brothers who died, one of them died of exposure, I suppose, or hypothermia or something like that, just by being left out in the cold, standing at a bus stop, a babe in arms. And then another one who died in his 20s, who died of blood poisoning, septicemia. A couple of words here I use, not so much used these days. Samhain's, the dish eaten at Samhain itself, Halloween. A dish of, oat husks, kind of gelatinous dish, I believe. Also known as flummery in the Welsh tradition, flummery. So anyway, here we go. At least they weren't speaking French. At least they weren't speaking French when my father sat with his brothers and sisters, two of each, on a ramshackle bench at the end of a lane marked by two white stones and made mouth music as they waited, chilled to the bone, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol-de-o, for the bus meant to bring their parents back from town. It came and went, nothing. One sister was weighed down by the youngest child, a grocery bag from a town more distant still, in troth. What started as a cough, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol, fol-de-rol-de-o, would briefly push him forward to some minor renown, then shove him back, oddly summary, down along the trench to that far-flung realm where at least they weren't speaking French. At least they weren't speaking French when another brother, 20-something, stepped on a nail no one had bothered to clench, in a plank thrown half-heartedly from the known to the unknown, falderol, falderol, falderaldio, across a drainage ditch on a building site. His nut-brown arm, his leg nut-brown, that nail sheathed in a fine down would take no more than a week or 10 days to burgeon from the froth of that piddling little runoff, falderol, falderol, falderaldio, and make of him a green and burning tree, his septicemia crown, sowens as much as he could manage, trying to keep that flummery down as much as any of them could manage. However they might describe the stench as exhalation, as odour, at least they weren't speaking French. At least they weren't speaking French when those 20-something council workers, one with a winch, the other a wrench, would point my son and me to a long overgrown lane marked by two faded stones, falderol, falderol, falderaldio, like two white-faced clowns gaping at the generations who passed between them and set down bag after grocery bag, setting them on the table, the newspaper tablecloth. 1976, not the East Tyrone Brigade, not Bader Meinhof, falderol, falderol, falderaldio, bringing the suggestion of a frown to those two mummer stones still trying to lie low, trying to keep their mummery down to a bare minimum. Two stones that, were they to speak, might blench as much at their own giving out as our taking in, that at least they weren't speaking French. Okay, so I think I'll just end. Do you have questions or observations?
How has being a professor at Vincent impacted your poetry?
So the question was, how has being a professor at Princeton impacted my poetry? Or how has it gone about influenced, how has it influenced how I write poetry or go about thinking about it? Well, you know, it's one of those things, the short answer is I don't know. The longer answer would be, you know, because one doesn't really know, at least most people don't know how anything much, you know, affects them. And in the poetry business, there is a critical, as far as I can see, there's a critical relationship between ignorance and knowledge. Not knowing what one's doing, and yet knowing a huge amount, as much as one possibly can. More, I have a sense of needing to know more than I do about almost everything. So being, one of the things about being a teacher, I suppose, is that one is forced to intellectualize things and forced to think through ideas about poetry and how poetry has been written in various cultures over the centuries, right? And I think the more one knows about the poetry that's been written, the better. The more one has read, the better. But of course, one then must put that to one side and be in a place where one knows nothing and try to have that kind of, you know, what Wordsworth described as wise passiveness, or the quality that Keats pointed to and described as negative capability, right? So it's, I suppose a way of answering your question is, it's good to know that Wordsworth had a term for this and Keats had a term for it, and then to know what it is, or have some vague sense of what it might be that they're referring to, the capacity to know nothing. So as a teacher, what I try to teach is ignorance, which is a tall order, you know? And it's a tall order for oneself. So, but one of the things about being a university teacher is that whatever it might be, it's not coal mining. What that means is that there might be time and energy to try to find that place where one is ignorant. Right? Does that answer your question? In other words, the university is a as Maynooth is also among other functions, it's a patron of the arts. You know, and that's one of the reasons why writers are so effective within the university structure, because they often, not always, but they often bring something to the discussion of literature that I suppose is has some sense of what's going on under the, you know, they have some sense of what's going on under the bonnet, as it were. Does this make any sense to you?
Yes, it does.
That'll be a first. Thank you. For me. Guys, thank you so much for having me here. What a pleasure to see you all, and thank you for your lovely introductions and your welcome. And thank you for making time in your such a lovely afternoon to come in here and listen to this stuff. What can I say? Thank you. Daniel O'Connell, O'Donovan Rossa, Charles Sturt Parnell, Patrick Pearse is sounding his own death knell as that gob of flame shines on the pavement in Sackville Street, a little gem. On Stephen's Green, one rare moment of mirth comes with the daily ceasefire in which a keeper feeds the dank ducks on their dank pond. For ourselves, there's a dearth of humour. Leave your jewels in the bank, the Countess told the girls. The only thing worth wearing's a revolver. It seems she shot one officer point blank. The whole world's foundering. A smoke trail tells of the fates of Caesar, Alexander, those who kissed their hems. Tara's ploughed under. Troy eventually fell. Surely the English will get what's coming to them. The dead horse's swollen belly has now so tightened its girth, it looks as if it might give birth to a replica of itself. In an effort to outflank us, the English have banged out a tank from the smoke boxes of two locomotives. The men with a hand on the tiller were so familiar with Tory sound, they thought nothing of taking command of the Asgard. To be renowned on Tory is to be world-renowned. From a burst sandbag, a skein of sand winds as it's unwound. The air tastes of grit. The world offers no safe berth. Tsar Alexander, the Kaiser, their serried ranks. Tara is debased. You see how deep Troy lies beneath the earth? The very English will sink as all those sank. Those who can't afford a uniform may wear a blue armband from which the meadow pipit filches a single strand to bind its nest. The rest of us are bound by honour alone. The English pound the GPO while we ourselves meet brute strength with brute determination. The pipit interweaves wondrous blue and that workaday sandbag jute. That the O'Rahilly was the last to know of the impending to-do, but first to execute the plan of attack, is ever so slightly skewed. The world's topsy-turvy, though. This dust's the dust that fanned Caesar and Alexander as each gained ground. Tara is under pasture. At Troy, it's clear how things stand. For the English, perhaps, their time will come around. Thank you.
Thank you.